Miss Pierce, Reel 14.
I wondered about was when you received word from your mother, who was badly blitzed and wanted you to return to England, what was your attitude about returning at this time?
Oh, I didn't want to. Because I knew that once I returned, I couldn't rejoin the unit.
Did you try to explain that?
Is that on the...
Yes.
There wasn't anything I could do. I felt a sense of duty, and I think they felt the same, and all arrangements were duly made by the Spears mission to get me home. So that I think I described how I got back from the desert into Cairo.
Yes. We stopped at Suez with you about to board the ship.
Yes, well, I boarded the ship called the Viceroy of India. There were other stray troop ships in the harbour, but we knew that coming, none of the troops were expendable, but going, we were all expendable. So we didn't go in convoy, we were on our own. Unescorted.
Why should you be more expendable one way than the other?
We weren't going to the war. We were leaving it. I don't know, but anyway, we were not considered so expendable. I mean, we were considered expendable. And troops coming out to join were not. Anyway, we were never in convoy. Ships going home went in lone sections, one ship. So, on board we found 1,001 German POWs to be transshipped in South Africa, going to South African POW camps, and many evacuees from Malta. Some were Maltese, some were English, wives of naval officers chiefly, and Malta being a very dangerous place at the time, England, strange to say, was a safer place for them. So the ship had a great many evacuees from Malta, as well as RAF returning home, and it was an RAF troop ship. In other words, the OC troops was an RAF officer. And also there were two QA sisters who were getting on in age and should have been retired some time before, but owing to the war, they got stuck out east. And one colonial sister also, very much overdue for retirement, and myself on nursing staff. Then there was an RAF physician going home to take his FRCS because he realised that he needed that as well as being a physician in wartime. So that was what our ship's company consisted of, apart from the merchant navy, naturally, who braved and risked their lives to take us to our destinations. We waited several days before we could leave port, and it took my mind back to that wonderful natural harbour at Tobruk and seeing the white hospital ship sailing out of our lives and the ruins of the Tobruk church behind us with the statue of the Virgin of Lourdes completely intact among the ruins and seeing the purple shadows across the desert. I remembered thinking at the time that beauty among such evil as war, because Tobruk was a very hectic and very war-ridden place. And there we were in this harbour, waiting, watching the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth sailing out at dusk and coming back in the morning, because it wasn't safe for them to stay in harbour at night, though it was beginning to be and say further out, because the Japanese submarines were about. Well, we sailed, and our first port of call was Cape Town. And I remember well the bumboat boys coming up. We had no shore leave officially, but there was one exception. It was Maundy Thursday, and I can only think it was because we had so many Maltese wives on board. But the Roman Catholics were granted shore leave to a 6 a.m. mass or 6:30 a.m., I can't remember which, in the dockyard or just outside the dockyard. And we went to mass in the morning, and I had got friendly with a ship's officer, and he said, "Don't get rid of your pass, because we'll try and use it to get onto Table Mountain for you." Well, the pass I was issued with, I'd be very grateful if you could read it out, because I can no longer do so.
It says, "Sister Pierce has permission to proceed ashore from the hours of 6:30 and 8, in accordance with DRO Section Number 28, Paragraph 2, for the purpose of attending church on 2nd April 1942. There's an illegible signature, and then Major for Wing Commander OC Troops 1442.
Yes, well, somewhere I've got that pass, but I can't find it at the moment. I shall have to get a sighted person to help me look for it. But I've kept the particulars, because it's quite interesting to think that we did have that. And when I got back ashore, back on board, the officer who was going to take me out later crossed off 0800 and left simply 6:30 on the pass. So we duly got to the time when we left the ship, and the Dutch police in the harbour looked at my pass and looked at me and grinned, because he knew very well what we were up to. And I said, "Well, I must go up on Table Mountain. I may never get the chance again. And I've been round here already once, and this is the second time." So he put a special dockyard stamp on the pass, which made it safe for me to get back to the ship. Without that special dockyard stamp, I'd never have got back into the harbour again, into the dockyard again.
How did you know you would have enough time for a trip to Table Mountain?
Well, the ship's officer being granted shore leave, it was obvious that the ship was not yet sailing, and he reassured my moments of anxiety on the subject by saying, "Well, I've got shore leave, and I know exactly what time to get back onto the boat, and you're quite safe, because it won't sail without us, and quite a few of us have got shore leave." So off we went, and we motored up to the overhead hanging railway, which took us up to the top. Unfortunately, Table Mountain is more often than not surrounded by cloud, and this was our fate. As we were walking along from one hotel to the other along the top, we couldn't see any of the beautiful views for cloud all round us. We were just a table with a tablecloth round it. And then suddenly the clouds broke for a little while, and it was breathtaking, the view all round, right round beyond Cape Town and beyond the sea and down into the harbour below, with all the different craft there waiting to sail. And then it was all, and just as we were looking, I got very worried, because a troop ship was slowly steaming out of harbour, and The ship's officer reassured me. He said, look, I'm with you. I know that that's not ours because I know exactly when she's sailing. And I repeat that I've got shore leave. So I was reassured and we went on with our trip on Table Mountain. And when we got back on the boat, I discovered that another person had also gone with a ship's officer. She was a Maltese wife of a naval officer going back to England, having been evacuated. And she'd gone to have her hair done on her church pass.
Had your absence been noticed?
Oh, I expect so. And point out that I wasn't very much of a Christian, was I, to keep my church pass for ulterior motives. However, we had both had a jolly good feeling about it. She'd had her hair done and I'd been up on Table Mountain. Well, we sailed on.
At Cape Town, you got rid of your Germans and took on some more
prisoners.
Ah, yes,
we did.
Had you had any contact with the German prisoners of war while you were on shipboard?
Yes, they cleaned the ship, and they cleaned it most beautifully. They kept the place in order, and one sort of saw them about the place. And maybe we said good morning, I presume we did. You know, just exchanged the odd word. And we put them ashore at Cape Town and took aboard 1,001 Italian POWs. And they didn't keep the ship quite so clean, but opera. We were treated to the most wonderful opera singing all over the ship as they proceeded to do their kind of cleaning. They were very jolly and very happy and not a bit difficult to get on with, and we just listened to opera. And on our way to Freetown, we played all sorts of different deck games and things to pass the time. And nearing Freetown, we heard that it was much more dangerous now than it had been when we came out in convoy, because there were Japanese submarines as far around as that, and German submarines, and lone ships going home had been sunk. And we got into Freetown, but this time we were allowed no shore leave at all. And am I mixing Freetown with Cape Town? Have we left Cape Town and have I got a bit mixed up?
I think you left Cape Town with the Italians.
Yes. Well, it was at Freetown. It was at Cape Town that we were allowed shore leave.
Yes.
That's right. Yes.
Yes, you made that clear.
I made that clear. And I'm sorry to be so vague. We got to Freetown and I presume we took on water and whatever else was needed. And there we heard that we would be doing a great deal more zigzagging than I had done in the past, probably almost to America to avoid submarines, which we did. Well, after we had left Freetown, an RAF sergeant and his guard were playing some game when the door opened and another sergeant who was to take his place came in. And at that moment, the sergeant sitting down playing a game pushed his Sten gun to one side and it went off and the relieving sergeant got the full blast in his stomach, right across his stomach. He was very badly wounded. And immediate action had to be taken, and all we had on board were two very old QAs who said they couldn't do anything about it, and one colonial sister, myself, and a very small sick bay, surgery, which was smaller than the room we're sitting in doing our recording. It was a very narrow little place, and a ship's so-called surgeon, who was an old man, and he couldn't take part. So the colonial sister was asked if she would assist the RAF physician, who had not much experience with operations, but it was the only thing we could do. And she said, no, she couldn't assist the surgeon. Would I do that? And she would be theatre sister. Well, I was terrified of doing this, but the matter was very urgent, and one couldn't say no. And with great trepidation, I assisted the physician to do a surgical operation, a major one at that. And after that, he was put into the little tiny ship's sick bay, which had one cot in it. And an RAF orderly was left with him, and we went up to a belated dinner that night. And I remember how very obliging the ship's crew were. They weren't a bit put out that we were so late. We had our dinner, and the coffee was still in the lounge. So we went up to the lounge for coffee and were very embarrassed at people sort of praising us for what was actually our duty. However, we got over this. And then the colonial sister and I had a talk about who was going to nurse day or night. And she said she would do day duty, and I said I would do night duty. I shared a cabin with one of the elderly QA sisters, so it was quiet. And that night, going down below deck, down the gangway to get to the sick bay, I was confronted with a very drunken army officer, and it was really getting very dangerous and very embarrassing, and he was very maudlin, and I couldn't get down the stairs, the gangway. And one of the boys in blue came, light blue came, and sorted things out for me and got me down to sick bay. And the following night, and from then onwards, there was always one of the light blue boys waiting to escort me down. And all night one of them slept rolled up in a sleeping bag outside the little sick bay. And I know for a fact that no one had ordered them to do this. This was their way of saying thank you for what you're doing for our sergeant. And I remember one day thinking, well, I'm sleeping awfully well. It's mighty quiet around here. And the cabin had one of those square portholes onto the deck. And I opened it and looked out and found just two RAF lads playing, I think one was a corporal or a sergeant, I can't remember, playing some mysterious game for money, which I believe the RAF play to this day. And the whole of the deck, each side of them, was absolutely clear, packed with troops further on each side, packed with RAF boys. And I put my head out and I said, hey, what's going on down there? And the answer I got was, sister, you should be asleep. We've cleared the deck so that there's no noise, and it'll be done like this till the day we land. And I often wonder now where these not-so-young lads are, and still in my heart thank them for all their kindness and the way they treated me during those days.
How was your wounded sergeant?
He was very seriously wounded, and it was touch and go whether he would even make the journey, especially as when we got nearer to England, we had to go right round Ireland and right up into the North Sea, and it was terribly rough long before we got there. It was frightfully rough. And the reason why one had to do this was that the Irish were sheltering German submarines, you see, and you couldn't come into Liverpool from the bottom. You had to go right out and well across the top into the North Sea. And it was the worst. I've done many journeys, and I did many journeys during the war, and I have never done such a nightmare journey as I did that time. I had to throw myself across the patient and lie across him to hold him steady from rolling in this terrible sea. I had to call the orderly in to help me once or twice to keep him in position in his cot. And we did this dreadful journey. And
did the Viceroy of India come into contact with any submarines or other dangers?
Well, we didn't officially know, but we did hear the odd depth charge in the distance. There might have been some navy operating somewhere out at sea, but we weren't attacked in any way. I believe, as we got nearer to Ireland, a mysterious plane came over, but nothing happened. And eventually we got to Liverpool, which I had last seen as a city, and it was terribly bombed. The most frightful state all along the harbour. And we put in there, and I was given permission to go ashore with the patient and see the sergeant safely into the ambulance. It was a miracle that he was still alive. And I often wonder to this day, did he live? And if so, where is he? And I would love to be able to contact him, but I don't know how to. But also on that trip, just after we had done this operation, a corporal attached to the OC troops commanding officer's office came to me, and he said, "Sister, you've been mentioned in dispatches." He said, "I've just sent the signal off with other dispatches via the Navy, who called on us yesterday." And well, I was only a little small fry in a large war, and to this day I've never heard anything more about it. So that was just one of those things. I suppose if I'd written to the RAF and asked them to trace back, sometimes I thought perhaps I should have written back to the RAF headquarters and asked them what had happened to the sergeant and whether it was true that I was mentioned in dispatches. But I think it was true, because the corporal wouldn't have taken the trouble to come and tell me.
No.
But I didn't hear anything more, and I've never followed it up.
So what condition did you find your mother in?
Well, when we got home, when I got to London, to my great chagrin, and you mustn't take this the wrong way, I found that Mummy had completely recovered, and that I need never have left Tobruk. It took such a long time, you see. All those weeks waiting in Cairo, and the journey, which took some weeks. So my journey had been in vain by the time I got there. And came the problem then of what to do, because I didn't know whether to, what to join, what to do. I had left some things of mine in charge of the nuns in whose hostel I had been at the beginning of the war. And they'd very kindly kept my things from my flat and various other things. And I went down there to see them, to collect my things or to see what to do about them. And I found a square hole in the ground. They had been bombed and everything had gone. So I went to the police, and They said that no one had been hurt at all because they had been evacuated from there to one of their houses in the country and one at Finchley in North London. And they then told me where to go to get my bombed out money, as we used to call it. And, well, red tape was, I think, pink in those days. It wasn't quite so red because within a week I got my bombed out money.
How much did you get?
Well, it sounds very, very little for nowadays. But I got £75, which was a jolly good sum then.
Yes.
And so I was all right there. And then the Ministry of... Meanwhile, I'd gone to the Hatfield Spears office, which was at the Ritz. And Doris Stanhope, who'd been with us in France, was our secretary. And she had been in touch with the Ministry of Information. And she had got a reporter there waiting to interview me. This went on for several days. And quite long periods of talking to her and being questioned about various experiences, both going out round the Cape and coming back. And you see, in those days, everything went through the Ministry of Information, so that it was difficult to contact a reporter. You know, nowadays, if you're interviewed by a paper or something, well, you contact that paper and that reporter if you want to. Well, Doria was absolutely horrified because, in my ignorance, I hadn't mentioned the word money. And apparently I should have been rather well paid for this because I was on the front page of most of the papers in the end. And serialized, I was told, in South Africa and America. But I got not a penny for this, because Doria thought that I'd made that arrangement with the reporter, but being as ignorant as I was, I had made no arrangement with the reporter, nor did I get any more contact with her, so we didn't really know how to contact her. I think Doria did contact the Ministry of Information, but I don't think she got very far. Though I've often had a sneaking wonder as to whether eventually the unit didn't get the money and not tell me, but perhaps that's a nasty thought in my mind. Anyway, meanwhile, the Ministry of Information asked me if I would, while I was waiting to see what was what, if how long I could keep myself. And I said I could keep myself for a certain time. And they said, well, in that case, would I lecture in various factories on frontline surgical nursing and what we'd been through, because it would give the women in the factories more incentive. They were making munitions, and it would give them more incentive to know the exciting part about it. Of course, theirs was rather a humdrum life between air raids and making munitions. And they took me somewhere in the remote regions of the country, I cannot remember where, and my first trial to see if I'd be any good was at a women's institute in a little wooden hut somewhere. And apparently they decided that I would be all right. So I was offered the princely sum then of a guinea a lecture, which nowadays sounds like a penny in the slot, but it was very welcome. And so I found a room in a convent guest house off Sloane Square, and stayed there whilst I lectured for the ministry in various factories up and down, going along in pouring rain and all sorts of air raids and things. And I remember the man from the ministry telling me that you'll know if you're doing it all right, because they'll